Law's Cool, episode number 6.
Hi, I'm Jacob Kaufman. I'm a 1L here at Western Law School.
My name is Omar Haredi. I'm a first-year law student at the University of Western Ontario as well.
Well, I hear you have some, you've done some interviews.
We've done a few interviews recently, and we're going to try to share those over the next few months. This past summer, the Canadian Bar Association, at their meeting, made a call to all of its members to take the case of Omar Khadr, who's a Canadian citizen currently held in Guantanamo Bay, to take it seriously, and they actually did write a letter to our Prime Minister concerning this case. We did have the opportunity to speak to one of the counsels for Omar Khadr. His name is Munir Ahmed, and he's a professor of law at the American University, so we're going to listen in on that interview now.
My name is Munir Ahmed. I am a professor at American University, Washington College of Law, which is in Washington, D.C. I teach immigration law, and I teach in an international human rights clinic. And it's in that capacity that from about the fall of 2004 until earlier this year in 2007, I was one of the lawyers representing Omar Khadr at Guantanamo Bay.
Okay. And just this past August the 24th, you had an article that was published in the Toronto Star. Would you be able to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It was one in a series of opinion editorial pieces that I've written for Canadian papers. And what I was trying to argue there was that if you look back at what Canada's response on the Omar Khadr case has been, it's largely been a response of inaction and failing to do very much at all to defend Omar's interests as a Canadian citizen trapped in Guantanamo. But in an article that was in the Toronto Star last week, there's a really interesting revelation, a reminder really, which is that Canada's, the government's very first response, just when the news of Omar's capture in Afghanistan first broke, mm-hmm. was really the correct one. And it was correct because what the Minister of Foreign Affairs said at that time was that the proper way to view Omar was as a child soldier. Mm-hmm. And as such, he was entitled to special protection under international law, mm-hmm. and that the appropriate way of the implication was that the appropriate way of dealing with child soldiers is to remove them from the zone of armed conflict, to rehabilitate them, and to return them to their families. This is based on an international consensus on child soldiers, which views children in armed conflict as presumptively victims rather than perpetrators of crimes.
Okay. And what is the justification currently used by the American administration to ignore the UN Convention on Child Soldiers?
Well, I think that the U.S. Denies that Omar is a child soldier. I think that although this has never been fully articulated by them, I think their view is that the enemy combatant category that is an invention of the Bush administration since 9/11 mm-hmm. is one that would trump the child soldier category, or alternatively would be a kind of exception to the child soldier. So that what we do know, because the government has conceded this, in its definition of an enemy combatant, there is no lower age limit. So our argument had been that as a 15-year-old at the time of the actions Omar's alleged to have committed, he couldn't be an enemy combatant, even if that were a legitimate definition. The government has said, no, he could be. There's no lower age limit on an enemy combatant. But, of course, if you follow that argument to its logical conclusion, that means that not only could a 15-year-old be an enemy combatant, but so could a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old or a 5-year-old, mm-hmm. and that's just nonsense. But nonetheless, that's the position that the U.S. government has taken. I think that to the extent that they would acknowledge that Omar was a child soldier, I think that their argument would be that the U.N. Convention and the Optional Protocol on Children in Armed Conflict doesn't require necessarily that he be sent back to Canada, that even the UN Convention would permit a prosecution for war crimes. And that's, again, something that they haven't fully articulated, but that's the position that I think they would take.
Okay. And how is the position that they've put forward been accepted by the international community at large? Has this statement of combatants and how they're not being under the Child Soldier Convention, has that been accepted by the international community or by scholars, legal scholars around the world?
I don't think that the scholarly community has accepted it.
Okay.
With respect to the international community more broadly, I think, unfortunately, there hasn't been as much activity on Omar's case as I would hope for.
Okay.
Among the human rights community, I think that they uniformly reject the position that Omar is somehow exempted from the Child Soldier Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they very much believe that Omar ought to be treated as a child soldier and that as such he's entitled to special protection. The committees of the UN, for example, have been largely silent on Omar's case, and other governments have not been particularly vocal. Although on that point, I would say that it's not really their responsibility so much to be vocal because it's a Canadian citizen who's trapped there.
Okay.
And it's really Canada's responsibility, I think, to take leadership on that issue.
And what should Canada be doing? And maybe you can contrast that to what other nations have done with their citizens that have been detained in Guantanamo Bay.
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that has to be understood about Guantanamo is that the condition of the detainees there is the result of politics and not law, and that it's through politics and not through legal action that detainees get out of Guantanamo. To put that in slightly sharper terms, there is not a single instance of a detainee getting out of Guantanamo through a court order or through any kind of judicial proceeding. People get out of Guantanamo because of the political cost that the U.S. faces for continuing to detain that person. And what that means then is that it's really up to individual governments to apply pressure to the United States to demand the return of their individual citizens. And when that happens, almost without fail, the record is that those detainees are released.
Mm-hmm.
To give you a couple of examples, all of the British citizens that had been detained at Guantanamo have been released. All of the Australians have been released. All of the French have been released. Omar now today is the only Westerner and the only citizen of a NATO country who is still at Guantanamo.
Wow. And why should that be a concern to Canadian law students? I mean, why would that be important to us?
Well, I think it should be concern for a couple of reasons. One is it goes directly to what the meaning and the value of citizenship is, and Canadian citizenship in particular. All these other countries have expended political capital with the United States in order to protect their citizens. Canada really has not. Canada, despite that initial statement in support of Omar's rights, really proceeded then to abandon him. And, as this Toronto Star article noted, it was the media relations people within the government who said they need to claw back on the message that Omar is a child. Those were the words that were used. There was another story just in today's Toronto Star that talks about how Minister McKay was advised at great length on how to avoid questions from the media and from other parliamentarians about the Cotter case. So it's this was a case where it was driven by media and political concerns, and what was lost as a result was the basic protections that a state owes to its citizens that really go to the core of what citizenship is about. So then to go back to your question, well, why should Canadian law students care about this? I think that Canadian law students should care about it for two reasons. One, if you're interested in how law operates and in particular how the state, as one of the primary actors in any legal system, how it operates and what its obligations are to individuals. The case of Omar Khadr is a striking example of the abdication of a state's responsibility to its citizen, to a child who is considered having special status in both domestic and international law, and one that tracks in very troubling ways onto racial and religious minority status.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's one reason that Canadian law students should be concerned. The second is that what the record of Guantanamo shows is that Canadian citizenship in the world is worth less than British citizenship or Australian citizenship or French citizenship, simply because the detainees from those countries who had that citizenship status got better treatment. And so the one last point I would make in that regard is that U.S. citizens aren't subjected to the illegality and the immorality of Guantanamo whatsoever. U.S. citizens are, in fact, exempt from that entire regime of interrogation and detention, and they're entirely exempt from the sham military commission process that was set up at Guantanamo as well. And so what we have then is a kind of hierarchy of citizenships. U.S. citizenship is clearly at the top in this regime. Our citizens can't be put before these sham proceedings, and they can't be subjected to these illegal forms of interrogation and detention. These other European and Western allies that come next, and Canada is really down at the bottom. It's down there with Yemen and Pakistan and Afghanistan and a bunch of other countries who haven't been successful in obtaining the release of their country, their citizens.
Wow. Okay. And if Canadian law students were interested in learning a little bit more about these issues, what resources would you direct them to?
Amnesty International in Canada has put together some great materials on the Omar Khadr case. You can just go to their website or just Google Omar Khadr and Amnesty, and you'll get some terrific information. There's a website called Cage Prisoners, which also has been tracking Omar's case very closely. I would also recommend just seeing what comes up when you and looking at blogs on Omar's case, because they're revealing, I think, of what the politics are around his case. I mean, everybody who knows anything about Omar's case knows that his family is deeply unpopular, and that's just a reality. But I think that the deeper, more profound question is, so what? So he comes from an unpopular family. What effect, if any, should that have on the treatment of a citizen by his government? In a liberal democracy, and you know, here I'm talking about any liberal democracy in the world, we treat individuals as individuals. But Omar's case, I think, really demonstrates, and when you read the blogs, you see a lot of this, this idea that the reason that Omar is stuck at Guantanamo and that the government is doing nothing on his behalf is because we don't like his family. And that's, you know, that goes back to that biblical admonition against visiting the sins of the father upon the son. That's not what we're supposed to do in a democracy, but I think it's hard to escape the reality that that's part of what's going on in Omar's case.
Look into it a little bit further.
And Omar, if I can make one more suggestion to your students, I think that they are supremely well situated to not just learn more about Omar's case, but to do something about it. What we have seen after several years of virtual silence from Canadian politicians and civil society is a real burst of activity in the last several months, demanding greater Canadian intervention in Omar's case. I think the most dramatic example of that is the Canadian Bar Association just 2 weeks ago came out with a very strong statement calling for Omar's repatriation. But there also are now dozens of parliamentarians and former government ministers who have publicly called for Omar's repatriation and for Canadian government's intervention in his case. So what does that mean for what Canadian students can do? Well, Canadian law students are future parliamentarians. They're also voters. And I think that what I would call upon your students to do is to write to their parliamentarians and ask what their position is on the Khadr case and urge them to take a public position, and also to write to the Prime Minister, because it goes back to the point that the resolution of cases at Guantanamo will not happen through the courts. It will happen through politics, and Canadian citizens are actually in a much better position to bring about a resolution to Omar's case than American lawyers are who have been working on his behalf.
Okay, Munir Ahmed, thank you very much for sharing your time with us today, and we hope all of our listeners to take this issue more seriously.
That was interesting.
It sure was, and you know what? We actually had the opportunity to speak to the president of the Canadian Bar Association on this subject as well, Bernard Amiot. So let's plug that in as well.
Cool.
My name is Bernard Amiot. I'm the president of the Canadian Bar Association. I started 2 weeks ago at our annual meeting in Calgary. But in my normal day life, I'm a lawyer at the law firm of Heenan Blakey, which is a national firm. I'm based out of Montreal. I'm a McGill Law School graduate, and I do mostly civil litigation and professional liability cases.
And I believe it was at this conference in Calgary where the Canadian Bar Association made a statement which attracted a lot of attention.
Yes, during our council meeting, we had one of the U.S. attorneys for Mr. Cotter address our meeting and reminded us that Mr. Cotter had been in custody in Guantanamo for more than 5 years, that he was a young child of 15 years old when he was captured and transferred to Guantanamo. And although we had taken position in the past about Guantanamo and the importance of respecting the habeas corpus in a generic way, we had never focused on Mr. Cotter's case, who was a Canadian national. So after his presentation on the same evening, we for my predecessor's signature, Parker McCarthy, wrote to our prime minister to urge him to negotiate with the U.S. government the release of Mr. Cotter, a Canadian citizen, from Guantanamo Bay, and so that he could be released into custody, the custody of the Canadian law enforcement official, to face due process under Canadian law. Because although he has been detained in very difficult conditions, I must add, for 5 years, and he was a child when he started, it took over 3 years for the U.S. government to even lay charges.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Canadian Bar Association's view for the past years in our previous letters to the Prime Minister is that the war on terrorism cannot be won by denying those suspected of terrorism
mm-hmm.
the fundamental right to answer charges in a fair and open process.
Why should the Cotter case be of interest to Canadian lawyers and the Canadian Bar Association, and particularly Canadian law students?
Well, I think it's very important to we as Canadian are champions, or like to be as Canadian lawyers, to be champions of the rule of law and the importance of due process and a fair trial. And here's a Canadian citizen who is subject to unfair process. Whether he's guilty or not is not the point we're trying to make. The point we're trying to make is that as any citizen, he has the right to due process and the right to also have independent counsel, which he's been denied because there's been interference by the U.S. officials with his right to counsel. One of his Canadian attorneys was searched when he ended his visit with Mr. Cotter the last time, and his computer was searched to find information about the privileged conversations that they had had. Mm-hmm. And there were attempts to intimidate him. And this is another aspect of the due process and the rule of law that is of the utmost importance for us as Canadians, as we like to be champions of the rule of law around at home and around the world.
And what would be an outcome that the Canadian Bar Association would seek to achieve from this situation?
Well, as we represent 37,000 lawyers and law students from all across Canada, we thought it was important for us, imperative to speak on behalf of all lawyers of the legal profession in Canada and remind our Prime Minister of his duties to that Canadian citizen. And obviously, I think with the credibility of the Canadian Bar Association, we're not a partisan, we're a principled mm-hmm. association defending important principles that are the pillars of our democracy. So I think we have a duty to speak out when these rights are denied. I hope that our intervention and other people's intervention, we're not the only one speaking out on this issue, and I urge all law students who care about these issues to do their own letter to the Prime Minister or on behalf of their associations or in any way they can help to put pressure on the Prime Minister to take heed of our message.
Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Well, that's interesting, especially because with a lot of this clash of civilizations rhetoric you hear in the media, you just found a very interesting article about how there might be some common origins and, in fact, an Islamic basis for some quite key concepts in Western law.
Actually, yeah. It's an article in the North Carolina Law Review in 1999. By John McDeesey, who's the Dean and Professor of Law at Loyola University in New Orleans. And it's entitled The Islamic Origins of the Common Law. And he talks about some of the linkages that occurred between the two legal systems, specifically the writ of debts, the assize of novel decision, and the use of trial by jury. As coming from North Africa through the Norman conquest of Sicily, which then followed the Norman conquest of the British Isles, and the introduction of those principles and many other legal concepts from North Africa and from Islamic legal systems into the common law, into what became the common law system.
I guess a lot of these concepts have business for lawyers in terms of Sharia or Islamic law. It's quite a booming market in terms of finance. There is an article in The Economist, How to Be Islamic in Business, which is talking about a man called Hussein Hamid Hassan, who apparently has cornered the market in the UAE and in many Gulf states and thinks they're going to switch almost entirely to Sharia business law quite soon. For example, interest is prohibited in Sharia. So for a mortgage, the situation would be the bank actually buys your house, your property, and then will sell it back at a markup through the installment plan. So that's similar in circumstance to our mortgage, but alleviates the tendency to actually give interest.
Well, there definitely are some business opportunities, and we do have an interview that we did with a rep associate at Ogilvy Renault, who's going to speak on some of those opportunities here in Canada and what their firm is doing in terms of this type of financing.
My name is Waleed Solomon. I'm a corporate securities and banking lawyer at Ogilvy Renault in Toronto.
I heard actually through the Ontario Bar Association that you guys are having a session on Sharia-compliant financing. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. We actually gave a presentation today to the real estate section of the Ontario Bar Association. Ogilvy Renault has one of the leading banking and structured finance practices in Canada, which lends itself to creative and interesting new structured products. One of the structured products that that we've been working on are Islamic finance structured products. These are products that are both retail and institutional and are designed to adhere to the personal beliefs of members of the Islamic faith. They're simply structured products in that they're products that would be very similar to anything that you would find offered by your local retail bank or your, on an institutional level, your international investment bank, but are maybe structured just slightly differently to adhere to those principles.
Now, for those of us who are not familiar with what those principles are, maybe can you describe them a little bit for us and explain why this type of financing would be different from other types of investments?
To take a very simplistic approach to it, I suggest that there's really three classes of principles that need to be applied to a transaction that's structured in an Islamic finance compliant manner. The first is that explicit interest can't be charged or received. The second is that investments can't be made in what are called a prohibited class of activities such as pornography, alcohol. Some have referred to it as almost a super ethical class of investments or products. The third principle is that your investment or lending contract can't be deemed to be a gambling contract. In other words, there needs to be some level of at least understanding slash certainty as to the means of return, and it needs to be linked to something more than just pure luck.
And why is this subject something of interest to lawyers and people in the business sector? And what exactly can lawyers learn from Sharia-compliant financing?
Well, really, most things that drive interest of our clients, there's a market, the market needs to be serviced, and there's money to be made. There's a growing retail market in Canada, and there's a very large institutional market in Southeast Asia and the Middle East for Canadian bankers, investment bankers, and lenders. At Ogilvy Renault, we have focused on both the retail and institutional clients, and they're involved in this because they're making money, and so we're there to service them.
So you're saying that as opposed to using lawyers and investment bankers domestically in their countries, they're actually coming here and asking for advice and counsel from your firm?
You know, Ogilvy Renault and other Canadian law firms do act on international mandates. Really, the most active engagements for a Canadian law firm would be Canadian engagements, you know, acting for Canadian banks interested in this area, acting for Canadian lenders interested in this area, acting for overseas investors looking to invest in assets in Canada in a manner that's Sharia compliant. So those would really be our primary target markets. It would be sort of things happening domestically, but we do and have acted on international products as well.
I was wondering if you maybe could help illustrate for us some examples of some deals that you've completed recently, just so we get a better idea of what it's all about.
Sure. We're acting, for example, right now for a group that's made an application to OSFI to establish Canada's first bank that will offer exclusively Islamic finance retail and commercial products. We are acting for another group that is making a significant real estate and entertainment investment in Canada and wanted to structure the investment on a Sharia in a Sharia compliant manner. We are acting for a number of investment funds that are looking to establish products in a Sharia compliant manner. We're acting for a bank that's looking to establish an institutional product, a Canadian made institutional product that's Sharia compliant, and offer it in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. So those are the types of products and clients that we've been working with.
I guess you don't have to live in the UAE to make some money in this sector.
No, there's definitely some domestic opportunities in the field, and even Toronto is being used for some of those international business opportunities as well. So definitely something for lawyers to keep an eye out for and possibly develop an interest and expertise in as well.
Yeah. Great. Well,
so we hope you enjoyed the show today, and hope you tune in for the next podcast. Thanks a lot.